Good afternoon. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Good afternoon, Forum Club members and guests. I'm Manny Garcia, the editor of the Naples Daily News. It is an honor not only to be a Forum Club member, but an honor to introduce our distinguished speaker, Clarence Page. It's been said that winning a Pulitzer is like catching lightning in a bottle. Well, Clarence has caught lightning in a bottle. In 1989, Clarence won the Pulitzer Prize for commentary. It's one of the most competitive categories in journalism, and I'm amazed by that. Congratulations. He's a nationally recognized syndicated columnist, member of the Chicago Tribune's editorial board, and an expert on national politics. We're fortunate to have a journalist of his caliber share his insight and wisdom this afternoon. Clarence is now reporting on his 7th presidential campaign. Yeah. He covered his first, the LBJ Goldwater race, as a high school editor and columnist in 1964. The timing could not be better for Clarence to be here today. We're coming off Monday's Iowa caucus win by Republican Senator Ted Cruz, a near photo finish between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. And with the New Hampshire primary next week, Clarence's presentation is even more important for our audience. Before we begin, let me give you a quick background on Clarence. He was born in Dayton, Ohio, and grew up in Middleton. He began his journalism career as a freelance writer and photographer for the Middleton Journal and the Cincinnati Enquirer at age 17. He graduated from Ohio University with a Bachelor of Science in Journalism in 1969. 45 years later, his alma mater inducted him into its Journalism Hall of Fame. And last year, Ohio University named him their Alumnus of the Year. Clarence was a reporter, producer, and community affairs director at WBBM in Chicago. Before that, he was a reporter and assistant city editor at the Chicago Tribune, where he shared a Pulitzer on a series the newspaper did on voter fraud. He's been a regular contributor of essays to the PBS NewsHour, a panelist on the McLaughlin Group, commentator on National Public Radio, and a frequent guest on a variety of other national radio and television programs. Clarence's other honors include Lifetime Achievement Awards from the National Society of Newspaper Columnists, the Chicago Headline Club, and the National Association of Black Journalists. In 1980, the Illinois UPI Awards, you know, he won Illinois UPI Awards for community service for an investigative series titled The Black Tax, and the Edward Scott Beck Award for overseas reporting in 1976. His latest book, a collection of columns titled Culture Warrior, was published in 2014 by Agathe Publishing. His earlier book, Showing My Color, Impolite Essays on Race and Identity, was published in 1996 by HarperCollins. Clarence is married, has one son, and lives in suburbs of Washington, D.C. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Clarence Page.
Thank you, Manny. Thank you very much, Manny. I appreciate it. Thank you. Somebody said, he doesn't look that old. Thank you, sir. You get the bouquet in the middle of the table there. Very good. Thank you, Manny. That was terrific. I am just really delighted to be here, and I want to thank you all very much for this invitation that rescued me from winter. You do not need, I've heard 30 apologies this morning for how cold it is outside. Boy, you lucky folks here. I'm still trying to thaw out from Iowa. Apparently, Ben Carson was too. Did you hear about that? I mean, right before the caucus, he disappears. Where is he? Well, he went down to Florida for fresh clothes. So what? No, he went to Florida to warm up. That's all he was doing. My goodness. Thank you very much, Manny. I appreciate that. As you heard, I am a columnist and editorial writer. I remember our great late colleague, Murray Kempton in New York, said editorial writers are like soldiers who come down from the hills after the battle is over and shoot the wounded. Needless to say, we have plenty of targets of opportunity these days. But I would say, before I go any farther, Mike McGuire, where are you? Right here, right in front. Mike McGuire, former foreign editor of the Chicago Tribune, is here today. One of the first people I met in Chicago journalism when I came back in 69. That's 1969, by the way. I mean, those who think I came right after the Civil War is a little overestimated. But those were the days, weren't they, Mike? We had typewriters back then. No news going through, pneumatic tubes going from one floor to the next, you know. Oh goodness, watch out. I'm at a stage of life we call my anecdotage. And there goes Dad telling one of his stories again here. And my long-suffering wife is here as well, ladies and gentlemen. Please give her a warm applause because she deserves it. No question about it. We were just reminiscing here at the table earlier. She doesn't tell this story very often, but how we met years ago back in my young and cool days. And I went to a reception for the Nelson Algren Awards there in Chicago and ran into this wonderful young woman who complimented me on this article I had written, and I was totally tongue-tied, except to just say, what do you do? She said, oh, I work for Playboy down the street. Need I say, I wanted to know this woman better. No doubt about it. But anyway, goodness, I can tell stories all day, but let's talk about, I hear there's an election going on. So I'll address that. I know you all love politics and this sort of thing. Anybody here watch The Daily Show on Comedy Central? If anybody saw me, let me know. Two nights ago on The Daily Show, they were taking off against the media. Nobody hates the media as much as the media do. And so they did a roundup of some of the bad predictions that were made in regard to this election cycle. And they went back and quoted major pundits on the Iowa caucuses and predictions as to who was going to win the Iowa caucuses. And needless to say, most everybody figured it was going to be either Donald Trump on the Republican side, Bernie Sanders in upset on the Democratic side. I was the only one that got both right. And I want to tell you, nobody saw this. Except me and my son sitting at home watching the tube. And this is the thing about predictions in politics. Everybody remembers my wrong ones, however. Just a few months ago, I was betting on President Clinton and President Jeb Bush. And I wonder what happened. You all can help me here now. But poor Jeb, I mean, it's like somebody once said of George Romney, Mitt's dad. He gave a fireside chat and the fire went out. That's what's happened to Jeb, right? I mean, man, you know, we were talking about Jeb, you know, as a governor, you know, the dynamism, you know, right on top of it with the debates and everything else. But nationally, there's a funny thing about the national stage. But the same thing happened. I was president of the Gridiron Club in Washington this past year, and our big dinner, we had President Obama agreed to be the agreed to speak for the administration. He ought to. He's in charge, and. We had Scott Walker agreed to represent the Republicans, and we thanked him very much. He did a great job, and we said, Governor, we hope you get that gridiron bump as you go into the presidential elections. Well, as you can see, he wasn't in long enough to get the bump. He was right out during the polling phase, you know, but this is where we are these days. Politics have gotten to be totally unpredictable, which I find comforting. I mean, it's frustrating, you know, when you're embarrassed on national TV. But what the heck, you're on national TV. Nobody feels sorry for you. You know? But I'm actually comforted by being surprised because it tells me that we are not living in Cuba. We're not living in Saddam Hussein's Iraq. We are living in a country where the people do decide. Doggone it. They get out there, and you never know what they're going to do when they get into the booth. So folks have to make some accommodation to listening to what's going on at the grassroots. I think this has been behind the big Trump surprise. I think I've been fascinated by how political correctness has become this big issue this year. And it's not a real issue in terms of there's something you can do about it, but you can certainly complain about it. But just by complaining about it, especially on the Republican side, it's an automatic applause line. Doesn't matter what you're talking about. You know, like. How are the Cubs going to do next year? Well, you know, as long as political correctness doesn't get in the way, yeah, that's right. You know, I mean, it's the all-purpose problem And why is that? To me, this when I see this happening, it tells me there's something underlying the issue. There's a frustration going on out there among a lot of people that issues are not being discussed by either party that they want to hear discussed. And I think this was something that Donald Trump, bless his heart, figured out. We have seen now the first truly media-generated candidate. He's not only media-generated, he's media. He knows media. I mean, he's been in our face for since the 1970s. I didn't realize this. I mean, the guy is even older than me by a few months. And he has been around for a long time, so people know him. He hasn't got any name recognition problem, hasn't got any facial recognition problem. People know Trump right away. And I thought, no, gee, this is some kind of a crazy whim that he is on right now. I said, well, I'm a billionaire now. I might as well run for president. But apparently he really has more of an agenda than that and have been thinking about this for a long time. In fact, folks who are associated with him say he'd been working on this for several years. Back in 2013, there was a meeting in Trump's conference room in that lovely Trump Tower there on Fifth Avenue. 25 political operatives met with him over deli sandwiches, and they were discussing the possibility of him running for governor, governor of New York. Trump did not want to run for governor. He had another plan. He wanted the whole enchilada run for POTUS, President of the United States. And according to Politico magazine, he said, you guys are going to be very helpful when I do the big thing. I love how he talks. You know, he's like they tell newspaper reporters, gear your writing toward the 12-year-old. Trump goes them one better. He gears his writing toward the 12-year-old's hard of hearing. He not only sticks with one-syllable words, but he repeats them and repeats them. And did I say he repeats himself a lot and repeats? He said, I'm going to walk away with it and win it outright. He said, I'm going to get in and all the polls are going to go crazy. I'm going to suck all the oxygen out of the room. I know how to work the media in a way that will never take the lights off of me, unquote. Now, this is a very interesting insight, and it is the sources are not quoted in this story, but I call it the kind of story that is too good to be checked out. You know? There are some stories that are just like that, you know, that's got to be it, because that's the key. Suddenly, this whole campaign season begins to make sense. You know, you look for that keystone, and I think, you know, this does make sense because, you know, I think back to the movies, and I don't know how many of you have seen, for example, Network, which has replaced Citizen Kane as my favorite movie, by the way, because I came out in 1975 and completely predicted Fox News. My son was, when he was like 10 years old, I showed him Network, and he was half over. He said, Fox News. I said, you got it, kid. You could be the next Roger Ailes. There was Network. There was Face in the Crowd, the 1950s, starring Andy Griffith. There was Elmer Gantry. And if you haven't seen Elmer Gantry or read the novel, you should. Magnificent. Elmer Gantry is about a gifted speaker becomes a great evangelist. Facing the Crowd is about Andy Griffith plays this guy who is found in a drunk tank and put on the radio and becomes a tremendously popular commentator, popular enough to run for president. And then there's Network, Howard Beale, who Glenn Beck calls his role model. I mean, Howard didn't make it all the way, you know. He, as the closing line in the movie says, the first newsman to die because of low ratings. I'll let you see the rest of the movie to figure out how. But this, to me, is I think Trump has seen all these movies and said, if they can do that, I can do that. I mean, the man knows how to build an image on TV. He knows how to build a narrative. He knows how to get at what people are really looking for and the kind of role models a lot of folks are trying to find. And I think this has been a remarkable experience for him because I don't know if he did much in the way of scientific polling or what, but he found his three key issues, immigration, trade, and save Social Security, Medicare, the safety nets. These are all issues that in Washington they call third rail issues, right? Touch them and you die. You know, Republican or Democrat, doesn't matter. They just don't want to talk about them. And I mean, you know, George W. Bush had what I thought was a reasonable privatization plan. It wasn't total privatization for Social Security, but it was to offer people the option of going to the stock market as opposed to going into the Al Gore's lockbox. They, of course, that was before the 08 stock market crash. But even so, the more he talked about it, the less popular it became. Folks just don't want to touch those programs. And Trump understands this. So he comes in with what I call the third party, the Trump party. It is one that is not Republican establishment, and it's not traditional Democratic establishment either, even though he's a former Democrat. And many people say he's a closet Democrat, much like Barack Obama's a closet Muslim. In any case, Trump understands that people, there is a constituency that hadn't been met. Now, I didn't realize this until I first saw the demographic polling on Trump's support, as well compared to the other Republican candidates. And as many of you know, he has more blue-collar support. Non-college, as the demographers call them, people who haven't got some schooling beyond high school. Those folks are also the folks who have been cashing it in the, you know, where, since the 50s. And Bill Clinton first made me aware of it during the 92 campaign. He went around campaigning talking about how if you don't have some schooling beyond high school, you are not likely to have any appreciation, any increase in real inflation-adjusted dollars for the rest of your working life. And why is that? Because of structural changes in our economy. When I was a young man in Middletown, Ohio, John Boehner's district, for those of you not familiar with it, right between Cincinnati and Dayton, very Republican, local license plate bumper stickers read, "Friends don't let friends vote Democrat." And Middletown, Ohio, not to be confused with the book Middletown, that's about Muncie, Indiana, but a similar place. Classic factory town. I worked my way through Ohio University, go Bobcats, by working the summers at the steel mill, Armco Steel. Tuition in my freshman year, and I had to go back and check this out, it is true, 1965, my tuition was $770. Not including room and board. Y'all remember those days? With room and board, it was $1,240. You know, my dad's a janitor, my mother's a cook. But I lived the American dream, like Marco Rubio would say. Thanks to that affordable education and an available job, I worked my way through school and was able to join America's wonderful middle class. Today, I don't need to tell you what the numbers are like on college tuition. I don't need to tell you about where steel is nowadays. My old grand steel mill is kind of a little boutique mill now, kind of a Disney World version of what it used to be. Not that job creator that it used to be. These are the structural changes in the economy that states like Ohio are dealing with. I know we got former Ohioans here because that's where Ohioans go. We come down here. In any case, this is a long-term issue in our economy and in our political landscape that has not really been dealt with directly by either party. Now we have Donald Trump on the Republican side, and we got Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side. And what's happening with Bernie Sanders? Bless his heart, a year ago he was this eccentric, gray-haired socialist, Democratic socialist, quote-unquote. I was turning to my son to explain this to me. He was this eccentric but charming, likable former mayor from Burlington. And now all of a sudden he is threatening the former First Lady, Hillary Clinton, who, according to my prediction list, she's supposed to get the Democratic nomination. So, you know, I'm getting folks in both parties now that are upsetting my predictions about the future. But why is this? In both cases, we're seeing a surge in interest by what Donald Trump calls the silent majority, which I haven't heard much since the Nixon days. But it is a layer of the electorate that has found a voice with these two eccentric personalities. sometimes it takes an eccentric personality to bring certain issues to the forefront. Now, the question to me, of course, is how effective can either Sanders or Trump be in enacting their agendas? First of all, presidents don't act unilaterally. We have something called Congress, as you may have heard, and the Supreme Court, both of which have been dedicated in recent years to making sure nothing does happen. And quite frankly, look around the country. Where do you see real reforms happening? And everything from health care to marijuana legalization is happening in that great laboratory of the states. And I suspect it's probably going to be that way for the immediately foreseeable future, because in the meantime, the national parties, I should say the national branches of the two parties, are still deciding where they're going to go. The Republicans have these deep divisions inside. The Democrats have a generational problem. They have a weak bench, pardon my mixed metaphors, but they're going to Super Bowl weekend. But they've got a very narrow bench. I mean, you saw poor Martin O'Malley trying to be heard up there on the stage, right? you know, where's the younger generation? It's all of us boomers are still running things. And folks, you know, Charlie Rangel, bless his heart, you know, doesn't want to get up out of his chair. And I mean, meanwhile, the Republicans are going out and finding folks like Marco Rubio and other new generation folks, which can create some new dynamism for their futures. Now, in the meantime, I think that, let me say, first of all, ladies and gentlemen, the State of the Union is sound. No, I'm not rehearsing for my administration, but the State of the Union is sound. You would never guess it by watching the Republican debates. At the same time, we have serious problems with wages, which, as I saw in the news this morning, wages are up finally. I mean, this has been the last part of the recovery to occur since 2008. At the same time, unemployment has fallen to below 5%. This is normally good news, but you would never guess it watching the debates. You hear about the sort of slowdowns that we've been having, and it's possible, in fact, that the Fed may not raise the interest rates in this next quarter with the current slowdowns occurring, because they're very paranoid about both inflation on one end and deflation on the other. But I'd say the State of the Union is sound, and the state of our candidates is just weird. We have, we have a situation now where, in order to keep Trump out, Ted Cruz is now the voice of moderation and reason. We have, the aforementioned Ben Carson. We have Chris Christie barreling ahead, bless his heart. He may do well in New Hampshire. We will see. Cruz has been told he will do so poorly in New Hampshire, he might as well just head to South Carolina, which may be true, because in Iowa, he did very well and won because of the evangelical vote more than any other. And Iowa's got Iowa Republicans, very high percentage of evangelical Christians. New Hampshire, I've been told, has probably the lowest church attendance in the country. I'm not going to say what that says about New Hampshire. I've been up there. I think it's God's country, whether they realize it or not. But anyway, it is. Cruz isn't expected to do that well. Christie may do well, and what that says about him. But in any case, I'm waiting for Tuesday to see if Trump is going to recover, because if he recovers before he gets down to South Carolina, where he's expected to perhaps sweep that state, depending on how strong he is going in, he's not going to let us hear the end of it. You know that. I mean, he already got up on after the Iowa caucuses and turned a loss into something that sounded like he just won something. Because everybody does that now versus Bill Clinton in 92, became the comeback kid. I'm also watching John Kasich from my dear beloved Ohio. He has been getting noticed. What was that line on Saturday Night Live used to have about Dan Quayle years ago? Still gaining acceptance. And Kasich is gaining acceptance. Listen to him. He's got a lot to say, and he's been a very successful governor in Ohio. And he is a fellow Deadhead, for all of you Grateful Dead fans out there. and he. So I've always liked him, and he never. Despite being a deadhead, is very sober-minded, and has been a great fiscal governor. And when folks hear more about his story, the more popular he becomes. But he's still trailing. And I heard Carly Fiorina this morning is very upset that she's not being allowed on the main stage at the next debate tomorrow night. And I don't blame her, bless her heart, but she was saying that, after all, people whom she has beaten in the past have already dropped out. So she deserves some points for that, right? I mean, there should be some longevity credits given here. In any case, the... let me see, how are we doing on time? Cause I want to hear your questions. Let me just close my formal remarks by saying that I'm optimistic about America's future. I want to say that because I'm hearing all the bad news going on about, oh, we're going down the tubes, America isn't America anymore, et cetera, et cetera. And they sound just like my grandfather tells me his father sounded back during that great election in 1895. I want to tell you, McKinley really helped us to move ahead. But there's nothing new under the sun. We have phenomena, have movements going on that we have seen before, and we will see again. It's part of that dynamism of our American project, and I think that we are going to have an election this year that's going to be, it's already something of a crossroad. We are seeing the demographic changes, the structural economic changes that have been building for the last 50 years kind of coming to a head now. We saw the Tea Party emerge right about the same time that Barack Obama was elected. But they were created under the last days of Bush. So their concern about the fiscal state of our government was alive under Republicans, it's still alive under Democrats, and it's going to be around for a while. But the Tea Party is not new. You can go way back in the history of our country and find there have always been movements or third parties out there arising to the issues of the time. They generally last for a couple of cycles and then fade. My McLaughlin Group colleague, Pat Buchanan, was one of the great populist leaders of the 1990s. Who would have thunk it? But he didn't win, but he did win enough states and win enough headlines that he had a big impact on the dialogue, what we were talking about in politics. In 2000, Ralph Nader made a big impact on the national dialogue. And Ralph Nader and Pat Buchanan were on stage together out in Seattle at the anti-WHO World Trade talks, and all the demonstrations were going on, which very few of us understood the issue at that time, but both Ralph Nader and Pat Buchanan came to a meeting of the minds on this because it was a left-right issue. And it's not new. You can go back to the know-nothings before the Civil War and find folks from the existing parties there that were sharing a certain populist view. So we've always had a popular strain in the country. And I remember in 2012, I was talking to my friend David Brooks. Notice how neatly I name dropped that. He was saying, well, you know, it takes a couple of cycles for a third party rump movement to play itself out. And this is only the first cycle. In other words, somewhere 2008 to 2012. So now 2016, it's two cycles. You don't hear much about the Tea Party now. Tea Party is still out there, but you don't hear that much about it. You do hear about Trump. You hear about Trumpism. You hear about, what did Sarah Palin call them, Trumpsters or Trumpets or something like this. The woman can turn a phrase, I want to tell you. She was a journalism major. What do you expect, right? In any case, I think there's some truth to this. So I think we are going through a cycle now and a phase. The national dialogue has changed. I hope we are getting more attention now to that wage disparity, the income disparity. To the opportunity disparity. What about kids who are coming along now who don't have the shot that I did as far as getting a good job, good enough to pay that tuition and move up to the middle class? I'm not hearing that kind of an agenda. It's kind of on the fringes right now. But for the long run, Republicans are concerned about their demographic makeup. The fact is that I've been thinking about my next book because my wife is tired of hearing me talk about, and I am too, I got to write the damn thing, about the, how the Party of Lincoln lost people of color. It is a hell of a saga when you think about it, across the history of the Republican Party. I mean, the GOP is my party, my newspaper's party. Our greatest editor back in Joseph Medill back in the 1850s heard that a legislator was down in the lobby of the Tribune who wanted to buy a subscription. It was Abraham Lincoln, this young up and comer, and Medill went down and shook his hand and said, and Lincoln said, "You're my favorite newspaper." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, because you favor the abolitionist cause like I do, and the Daily News over there is the Copperhead paper." So Joe Medill talked to Lincoln over time and asked him to join this new party they were putting together called the Republicans. Lincoln was a Whig, and Medill thought Lincoln could be president, and Lincoln said, "And how about vice president? I've been thinking about that." He said, "Abe, nobody runs for vice president." Famous immortal line, which lives with us today, ladies and gentlemen. But the Chicago Tribune, Abe Lincoln was our first Illinois candidate for president that Chicago Tribune endorsed. Barack Obama was the first candidate for president who was not a Republican that we endorsed. But that's Chicago. We have long memories in the town. As the first mayor Daly or Richard the First used to say, it's a town of Irish Alzheimer's. You forget everything but the grudges, and so a great town to be an up and coming reporter, a great town to see how politics really works at the grassroots level. And I look forward to seeing more of the way politics in this country works, as my grandmother used to say, if I be living, through the next couple of cycles. And thank you all very much for inviting me. Thank you. Manny, your turn.
All right. Way to go.
Thank you.
All right, man. Firing squad time. Here we go. Now, we got some really, really good questions. So we're going to start with the students because they've got some really, really good stuff.
Oh, good.
So
I love it.
And it ties into a question from the larger audience that has to do with voter turnout.
Oh, well, thank you.
But what impact can the younger generation of voters have on the election? And should candidates reach out to that younger electorate?
Oh, very good question. You know, I think, Let me try to be brief, which is an unnatural act for me. But this always happens, you know, and I say the same thing to my son. The kids don't vote. This is the problem. When I say kids, I mean, you know, under 30, a third of them vote compared to the over 55s, over two-thirds of us vote. And that's why you see so much more money in the budget for Medicare and Social Security than you do for education, grade school, preschool programs and all. You got to fight for that. And I told my son, you know, you got to vote or you don't count. It's the way it is. And, of course, you know, it goes in one ear and out the other. But he was coming out of high school. One person got him off the couch, Barack Obama. My kid went out and volunteered to work for Obama's campaign. And I said, I got to find out more about this Obama if we got my kid off the couch. But it was terrific. But 2 years later, and I mean, I can tell you more stories about that. But anyway, 2 years later, though, my kid is very disappointed, doesn't want to vote. I said, what's wrong? And he said, Guantanamo's still open. You know? And my kid, the chance he had to interview Obama for his high school paper when Obama was a senator, he was promising he was going to work to close Guantanamo. Well, my kid thought if a candidate promises he's going to close Guantanamo, then Guantanamo's going to close. And I said, well, son, something is in the way of him doing that. It's called Congress. And they don't want to close Guantanamo, and he can't do it by himself. So anyway, he was so disappointed, he just lost interest in voting. And a lot of his friends felt that same kind of way, you know, the glamour, the bloom was off the rose, et cetera. I see a lot of that happening this time. That's why I'm glad to see Bernie Sanders getting kids out. You know, I don't think, you know, I love his idea of expanding Medicare for everybody. Unfortunately, it falls about, what, $9 trillion short in its first decade of operation. Not a minor detail, but, you know, it doesn't stop Bernie, and the kids love it. You know, first thing that comes out of his mouth is free college tuition. Hey, I'll sign up for that, you know. And but, you know, this is how kids have to get introduced to it early, but it does take work to get kids out because they will not, and again, I mean, a kid to me is under 30, because they have to be wooed every election cycle, unlike those of us who are already planning to go down to the voting booth now next November, and it's only, February. Sure. So, so suffice it to say, get involved and things will happen.
What is a key characteristic in a person who wants to be a change agent, also from students?
Well, every election is about change versus more of the same. And those who want to be change agents, and I mean, you know, Barack Obama was the change candidate in 08. This year, the Republicans are the change candidates. To be a change agent, you must have a vision, have a dream, have a goal, and then figure out how you're going to get to that goal. Some people are, Malcolm Gladwell talks about mavens and other natural leaders out there in the community. Every community has certain people that just become leaders who have a certain charismatic impact or they're just so good with people that they become leaders and are great organizational people. And so that's how you become a change agent. But you have to figure out what you want to change from what to what, as Barbara Jordan used to say. And once you figure that out, it's kind of like back when I was trying to learn to be a writer, and I was told when you got an idea in your head or there's a book you want to read that nobody else is writing and you can't find it in a bookstore or a library, then write it yourself because then you'll have the passion, the desire to want to complete that job. And that was how I wrote my first book, and I find that that's how campaigns get started. Donald Trump has a vision, and he doesn't think things are running the way they ought to be running. My problem is I can't figure out what his vision is, but he does want to change things. And I think he lacks clarity in that regard that's going to doom him in the end. But those people who are getting out there trying to become office holders do have that kind of vision.
Okay. So a large share of the questions address similar issues along the lines, which is it's a three-part question here. Do you expect to have an independent third-party candidate? Who are going to be the party's nominees? Mm-hmm. And who will win, ultimately, the POTUS?
No pressure, Clance.
Now, I'm the guy who said it was going to be Hillary versus Jeb, and you're still asking me for my prediction. Yeah. Thank you very much. In any case... So what was the first part of that?
Third party. Third party candidate.
Okay, third party. What we were talking earlier about is Bloomberg going to get in?
Right.
I think Bloomberg decided he wanted to get in, or at least let people know that he wanted to get in, when he saw that Hillary was starting to the gap between Hillary and Bernie was closing, there's still a real chance out there that Bernie could win. I think that when they get to the big states, that gap is going to open up again. We saw this happen between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama back in 08, at that time Hillary Clinton was better wired in with the state parties and their organizations, you know, Pennsylvania and Florida, Texas, et cetera, et cetera. And so she froze Obama out in the big states and thought that was going to be good enough. But his strategists, which included a young fellow named David Axelrod, who used to be an intern under me on the night desk at the Tribune back in the 70s. I don't know whatever happened to the kid, but he likes politics a lot, I hear. But anyway, Obama's team said, that's okay, we're going to build up enough votes in the smaller states. And they did, and got the nomination. What I'm saying is, to build a third party, you've got to work the states. And Pat Buchanan and I were just talking about this a couple of weeks ago, every state is a separate presidential campaign. So you've got to build a party organization in each one. You've got to get on the ballot in each one. That takes time. It takes money. And then, of course, name recognition and charisma, getting a following. And then the worst part of it, of course, the riskiest part, is the three-way split. Three-way elections are impossible to predict. It makes them so much fun to cover. But if Bloomberg... I think Bloomberg might seriously want to get in if Bernie looks like he's really got a shot at getting the nomination, and it's early enough for him to be able to build that 50-state organization the way Buchanan was involved in that back in the 90s. But I don't think he's going to quite do it. I think wherever he goes, it takes any kind of poll, he's going to find that the popularity of his ban on 16-ounce soft drink cups will just doom him in this country. I mean, we love, I never order one of these big jumbo whatchacallits, but nevertheless, I appreciate the freedom to go and kill myself with sugar. You know, and I think a lot of Americans, it's the kind of thing about us Americans, we want our freedom. We don't want you telling us what's good for us, nanny state and all that. And I think that's really going to hurt Bloomberg. I don't see any other possible third party folks, although Trump might do it if he wants to be really unpopular. Because, as everybody knows, if Trump runs third party, it's going to really hurt the Republicans. Bloomberg, I think, undoubtedly hurt the Democrats. I mean, I know he used to be a Republican, but he's a New York Republican, which is kind of like a Texas Democrat, you know. I wish I was joking, but I'm not. It's really, this is part of the diversity of our politics here. I think he would really hurt the Democrats more than the Republicans. But that's why we don't have third parties getting very far anymore. Back when Teddy Roosevelt, even his Bull Moose Party effectively elected Woodrow Wilson. And that's the kind of scenario that neither party wants to do, you know, kick it over to the other one. So I don't see that going anywhere. Now that was the easy question. Now the hard one is who's going to win this year.
We'll just get cut to the chase.
I think the smart answer would be it's too early to tell. But I would say right now, though the odds are looking very good for Marco and Hillary, and I don't see anything effectively getting in Hillary's way. I think the more she campaigns,
even the emails, because that's the other question I was going to ask you.
Oh yeah, the emails. I predicted on the McLaughlin group that the FBI will recommend prosecution, but that she will not be indicted, and I didn't think that was a very remarkable prediction, but Breitbart headlined it. Clarence Page predicts that she's going to blah, blah, blah. So I guess since I'm branded as a liberal, the very fact that I acknowledge there's any case at all against Hillary was a headline for Breitbart. But the fact is, you can find a technical violation very easily she was responsible for any classified information that came in under the letter of the law. She's responsible for classified data or information, whether it's marked as such or not. She uses the reasonable excuse that it was not marked classified, and therefore, you know, it was marked classified later on, but that she did not intentionally leak secrets like Edward Snowden, for example. The Snowden case is the one that the law was written for to apply to, not the accidental disclosure. I was thinking about that this morning, Manny, because during my Army days with the valiant 212th Field Artillery Group, which defended our freedoms from Bavaria, and some of the finest beer halls I have known, but in any case, we were engaged in an exercise. Right now, the Obama administration wants to beef up our equipment in NATO and in Germany. This, just to give Putin a scare, you know, just wake him up a little bit. Hey, pal, you know, you caused too much trouble. We're going to bring some troops over there, and we're going to roll the tanks on you, etc. This is not a new idea. We had, back in my day, we had what was called reforger, returning forces to Germany. And since I was an enlisted man, draftee, I was assigned one day to stamp these documents classified on every page, which I did. And I got my first experience with something Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan later investigated extensively. Most of our classification is done not to hide stuff from the Russians or other enemies, but to hide stuff from Americans. Most of these documents, we're talking about stuff like our troops came in to go and jump into their jeeps and their APCs, our armored personnel carriers, etc., found bird's nests on the engine blocks. Nobody had maintained this equipment. And so it was virtually useless until it could be maintained. In the meantime, if the Russians wanted to move in across Germany, they would have been in Paris by then. In any case, now this is something, I just told you something that was classified in 1970. Yeah. I don't know if it ever got declassified, but I could have just broken the law there without even knowing it. And this is the kind of thing I don't think any reasonable person would prosecute, I hope. Otherwise, my next book will be a jail memoir. But this is where Hillary Clinton is right now, and that's why she has that confident look. What troubles me about the Clintons is not that they get in trouble occasionally, because you expect some trouble for anybody trying to do something in politics. What troubles me is how untroubled they are by it, because they're so used to being pursued, to having scandalous headlines and all kinds of speculation and all, but they kind of brush it off. And I think that troubles a lot of people. That's why Hillary Clinton has this honesty problem that a lot of Bernie's followers are using against her. So I think that's my feeling about the...
Well, play that out. Let's just say you've got Rubio.
You give me a short question. What do I give you?
It's fine, but I'm saying... Yeah. So let's say you have Rubio and Hillary Clinton. You're going to have a historic vote because Hispanic
that's
woman.
Right.
So how do you think that plays out?
I think, my personal feeling is once you've got a black president, all the barriers are taken care of. It's interesting. Now, I may be wrong, but I guess a Muslim president, maybe that's the last barrier nowadays, the way things are going. Back in 08, we had, for folks interested in diversity, we had an embarrassment of riches, because you had a woman candidate up against a black candidate. Or if you prefer, half, a mixed race candidate. So either way, history was going to be made. We got kind of spoiled in America now. It's kind of, here comes another minority. Which one is it this time, So I don't think it's that big of a deal, unless one of them was a Muslim. But we found that Barack Obama's case, he's not a Muslim, but approximately 15% of the electorate thinks he is anyway. And about 40% of Republicans, if you ask them, and I know a lot of them don't really think he's a Muslim, but it's just the thing you say if you're a Republican. It's like a kind of an identifier, just like Democrats will say, poor W and his cocaine habit. We never prove the cocaine habit, but a lot of folks believe it anyway. And so there's always a subtext of legend that goes along with politics. So I hope that answers that question. comes fairly close. Right there, kind of like horseshoes. It comes close, right?
Yeah. So one of the questions that came up, actually, several folks were asking about, despite strong gun laws, Chicago's had the largest, highest number of deaths in shootings. So address that issue.
Well, very, very briefly, I hear this all the time. And I think the point is that gun laws have something to do with high homicide rates, or they have nothing to do with high homicide rates, one way or the other. But I say, put it into context, New York City has the stronger gun laws than Chicago, and they have a much lower homicide rate and a much larger city. But what's the difference? New York State is surrounded by other states that also have tough gun laws, Connecticut, New Jersey, et cetera, whereas Illinois... Chicago itself is surrounded by a state called Illinois that has loose gun laws. You can go out to the suburbs and buy your gun, in other words, without having to worry about jumping through a lot of hoops, or go across the border to Indiana without jumping through hoops. It's not a question of whether or not you have strong gun laws. I think you've got to have it nationwide, or it's not going to do that much good. So I can see why the NRA is scared that we want to take guns away. I don't want to take guns away. I just want something sane like background checks. 80% support in polls for background checks before you buy a gun. And I mean, as a gun owner, I'm a former gun owner, but as a gun owner, I feel like I just want people. I want to keep guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't be having guns. And so any hoops I can throw in their path to jump through, I'm in favor of. So I think that's why this issue continues to percolate.
All right. Last question, Tufer. Have you ever considered running for office? And is this a time to buy Tribune stock?
Number one, I have considered running for office, and I put it immediately out of my mind before my wife gets any nervous looks. You think Michelle Obama doesn't like politics? Talk to my wife. Anyway, I immediately put it out of my mind, because why should I want to put myself through what I put politicians through every day? The other question,
just a quick Tribune question. Stock.
Oh, Tribune stock. Do we still sell stock? I'm not sure.
Yes.
Tribune's going to be around. We're big enough and have enough resources. We're going to be around. But like all other media, all other paper media, we are also on the web. Firewalls and ways of charging or luring you in and then charging, like a good heroin dealer does, you know, get them hooked and then start charging them. We're trying everything we can. But the fact is, paper is going out, but news is not, as you know. look who I'm talking to here. And I think, as far as the future goes, I haven't seen your balance sheet, but I have found that the middle-sized newspapers, in fact, have a lot of advantages over the really big metropolitan dailies because you've got that market to yourself more as far as both covering local news and selling ads locally. Whereas the web is really, it's international. You put something on the web, anybody on the planet can get to it. And so that's a different kind of market. It's a different way of covering news and providing content. But we're all going through changes. I used to be a journalist. Now I'm a content provider, because we're all, you can write it, you can talk it, you can pull out a camera or pull out your iPhone. You got a whole TV studio in your iPhone. You go out there and shoot a story. It's a different day. I'm very excited by it. I think I would not invest in paper, but I would invest in media that have a future, and those are the ones that are providing the best content. And we used to call ourselves the world's greatest newspaper, right, former Chicagoans? Now we're the world's greatest content providers. So thank you very much.
So you're bullish.
Thank you, Mr.